into the beauty, into the peace, into the concentration. So maybe it was nice. It was also, I hope it was nice way of introducing you to each other, to a few people. And then maybe over the course of the 8 months, you'll meet a lot of people in this group. I want to say a little bit more. The plan is to stop for lunch in 35 minutes, or about around 12:15. And when we do, we'll take an hour and 15 minutes for lunch break. But for now, I want to kind of partly repeat what I did earlier, but I think I want to do it partly for emphasis, and maybe I'll say a little bit more about it. So meditation is made up of different mental components, different aspects of our inner landscape, inner world, come into play when we meditate. And it's useful to have a sense of some of the important elements of what that is. And so when the Buddha taught mindfulness meditation, there are three discourses that are called the three sati discourses, mindfulness discourses. They're all in the middle length discourses, and one is the discourse on the four foundations for mindfulness or for awareness. The other is mindfulness directed towards the discourse on mindfulness directed to the body. And the third is kind of the reference point for this program, which is the Anapanasati Sutta, the discourse on mindfulness of breathing. In all three of them, the first exercise that's given involves three different actions in the mind. And the first is knowing, this recognition factor that we just talked about earlier this morning. The second is feeling and sensing, which I mentioned before, which we'll do a guided meditation about that in the afternoon. So the physical embodied felt sense experience of what's happening for us. And the third thing that it's emphasized there is relaxing. And the calming of the body, specifically calming so recognizing, sensing, and calming the body, relaxing the body. And that's how the instruction begins in all three of these mindfulness texts. And from there, the instruction changes and moves along in different ways. But they all have this in common. And I like to see that that this is a wonderful foundation for meditation practice. So if all you did was to know, feel, and relax, you'd probably go a long way in meditation. And you don't have to learn, you don't have to know a lot more. I mean, it could almost be enough. And but there are other things that come into play as the practice deepens. One of the things that, in terms of our faculties of attention, how we pay attention, what we pay attention with, there is in this tradition the idea of kind of like an inner eye. For people who are blind, maybe we should say an inner way of perceiving. But the tradition talks about, uses the language of seeing. So seeing with the mind's eye. And is a important component part of the deepening of mindfulness practice. And because this has to do with the deepening of it, we won't get to it for many months. Even though some of you, it might be the primary way you practice mindfulness is you feel like you're just observing what's happening. But as a program here, we'll get to that later on. And then even more later on, we'll get to the simplest, cleanest, clearest kind of awareness that the tradition emphasizes, a precursor for awakening that I translate as lucid awareness. And some people like to translate it as bare mindfulness. Kind of mindfulness is very, very simple and just kind of present for things as they are. So those are some of the attentional factors that come into play. And I suppose we can probably come up with other things that to kind of fall into the camp of attention that gives us data about what's happening and what's happening in our experience besides those. But those are the primary ones. But there's other mental components of meditation, and one has to do with attitude. What's the attitude in which you're meditating? In what way are you applying yourself? What's the mood, the emotion, the beliefs that come into play as you meditate? attitude can have a huge impact on meditation. Attitude can almost be like the defining. Almost be what defines the direction your meditation goes. If you're in a grumpy mood and you meditate grumpily, it might be that you're becoming an expertise on grumpiness. You get learn how to grump better. If you meditate in a kind way, that has a very different effect on the experience. So the attitude is important, and one of the common emphasis in this tradition on attitude is to have a non-judgmental attitude, maybe it's not quite right, but it depends what you mean by judgmental. I think in colloquial English in our meditation circles, judging tends to mean to to assign a worthiness or a value to what's happening to us. In the tradition, there's a lot of judging that goes on in the early tradition, but it's more like a value. Maybe it's better, closer to what in English we call evaluation. We're able to evaluate distinctions, see how things are different, and see the consequence of things. And so, so non-judgmental meditation or mindfulness doesn't necessarily mean that it's non-evaluative. But for many people, to offer that there's evaluation involved, discernment involved as we do mindfulness, makes them feel like now they're getting even more busy. And the attitude by which people are evaluating and discerning is often an unfortunate attitude. And so it's just for many people, as a beginner, it can work so well to be taught non-judgmental awareness, non-evaluative, non-reactive, just allowing things to be as they are. So this belongs to this whole world of attitude, and understanding how that becomes a part of the practice is important. There is our capacity that's a little bit different than attentional faculties, but our capacity for concentration. Our capacity to really attend to one thing unwaveringly, and maybe even zero in, kind of laser in a certain kind of way, on the experience. That plasm also has a role, and it comes into play in meditation practice. The Brahmaviharas and Anukampa, the care and the love and the kindness that we bring, are elements that are important for it. Joy, happiness, well-being, peace, relaxation are all components of this. And it certainly was a surprise to me after years of Zen practice to learn that in this Theravadan Buddhist meditation practice, that joy and happiness not only are fine to experience, they're actually considered to be important stepping stones in the path of practice, and that we want to, it's really useful to develop meditative joy and meditative happiness. And I think now with the modern world of neurophysiology, understanding what goes on in the brain, we're beginning to understand that our capacity for attention, how we pay attention, and how attention picks up the experiences we have, is partly dependent on neurotransmitters and hormones that circulate around, and that the joy and happiness of meditation releases a different set of neurotransmitters and hormones than, you know, being stressed out. And so, you know, the Buddha didn't know about these chemicals in our system, so he just encouraged people to develop joy and happiness. And maybe that's enough, but if you need more, you know, encouragement to be joyful and happy, it may be nice to know that you're getting a good dosage of neurotransmitters that support meditation practice. And so joy and happiness, and then equanimity, there's something that's called gladdening the mind. It also helps to understand some of the core components of practice. Like what I mean now is understand how the tradition, how it understands the body. We take the body for granted that we know what our body is, but the tradition, when it offers meditation practice and instructions, they have a very particular understanding of what the body is, which if you understand it, you understand how the body has an intimate and integral interactive quality with the mind. And so it's easier then to engage, maybe enter into our bodily experience with understanding that connection, the body-mind connection. And then understanding something about what the tradition means by mind, citta, and how dynamic it is, and how much of a big role we have in the shape, the character, the functioning of what we call our mind. That the mind itself is not a fixed thing. And so we also have a role to play. And so to understand how the tradition understands what the mind is also part of this, what's useful in the kind of deepening of meditation practice. So we'll be looking at these component parts slowly and steadily as we go through. And in doing so, we're going to follow the sequence of meditation that's presented in this discourse of the Buddha called the Mindfulness of Breathing, Discourse of Mindfulness of Breathing, Anapanasati Sutta. Some people will use the Pali language for this practice of Anapanasati. And it's a time-honored Buddhist practice of meditation on the breath that goes through 16 steps. And those 16 steps are divided into four groups of four. And so each group is called a tetrad. And so we'll begin with the first tetrad and take our time through it. And you don't have to go through, you know, it is a sequence that you could imagine going down sequentially, you know, deeper and deeper and deeper. But it doesn't always work that way. Some people's meditation just jumps all over. You know, some people go backwards. Some people start in the middle and go backwards and forwards, or you know, all kinds of, they jump over. And so don't be too concerned with whether you fit the sequence. And you don't have to be on the same page as we in these months as we're talking about these elements for the of these 16 steps, because I'm hoping that the highlighting of these different component parts of meditation, these different aspects, will be useful independent of whether you're not at you're at that step itself. And some of you aren't interested in these steps of mindfulness of breathing, but as we go into some of the component parts, hopefully they'll be useful for the way that you meditate, to enrich it and to help you develop it further. The 16 steps are one approach that the tradition has for describing the deepening of meditation practice, which is the name of this program. And so there is a kind of developmental model, in a sense, of the themes and the ideas we're going to be looking at and the readings you'll do as we go through it. And some of the deeper parts of deepening meditation program then, of course, will come near the end. So those are my introductory words. And do you have any questions about, especially about attention. I talked about the component parts of the of meditation and, you know, the different attentional faculties we have. And do you have any questions about what I've said so far about attention that you'd like to ask? Rocky?
Yes, hi, thanks. So we talked about knowing, sensing, and calming the body. To me, it sounds like sensing is part of knowing. And just want to, my question is there a distinction between the two? And if so, how would one think about it?
I appreciate the question a lot. And I, you know, I don't know if I really qualify to, anybody does, to really answer such a good question, because it's so individual, these elements of how attention works. So I want to emphasize that, not I want to avoid answering your question, but I want to start by saying that, because whatever I say doesn't necessarily represent what's works or what's your case. And so the real answer should be putting the mirror back to yourself. And if you're, and if in your experience there's no separation, no hard and fast distinction between knowing and sensing, then that's true for you, as long as that's what's happening. That might change at some point. But you're working with, you have to work with what you have. And if that's what you have and you see it that way, then you work with that. So my belief is that knowing and sensing are very overlap some. It's very hard to not to have some knowing with any sensing that we do. And it's possible to have knowing without any sensing, I think. I think that it's possible to be abstractly in your head and know something, and you don't really have any much feeling that goes with it. And, I mean, technically speaking, in the present moment experience, you don't know anything unless there's some sense organ involved. And so if I see and I see the clock, seeing is the sensing. The recognition of the clock is the knowing. So they both come into play. And so it might have something to do with the strength of each. And sometimes one is emphasized more than the other. Some people are very somatically based. And so what's easy for them to access is the physical experience of something. And that becomes a real grounding source for them to be in the present moment. And the knowing is less important initially and becomes maybe important later. Other people are much more cognitively based than physically based. And so their way of grounding in the present moment comes a little bit more through knowing. And then the sensing comes later. And there's probably other ways that people, you know, it works for people. But so is that an adequate answer for now for you?
Yeah, something I can explore definitely helps me untangle it a little bit more. Thank you.
Thank you. Then Margarita.
Hi. So I'd like to hear more about what suggestion you have about cultivating attentions, because what I heard so far is that it's like a muscle, that the more you practice, the more it develops. And the second piece is pay attention to what distracts you and learn to let it go. That's it. That's all I know about attention. So if you have anything else that you can suggest to cultivate our ability to maintain attention, I'd like to hear it.
Nice, nice.
Thank you.
So first you have to appreciate that I use the word attention as a very broad category word that encompasses all the different ways that we can be aware of something. So attention is what allows us to hear a sound or smell a smell, or it's just kind of the general kind of word for that. And so the particular things we actually do that supports attention are things like recognition, clearly recognizing what's happening, sensing and feeling the experience, relaxing around all of it. So the three that I'm emphasizing now. And so, and some people who just simply have a kind of open, kind of general, kind of more vague or indefined kind of sense of being, having it, having attention, they have a harder time with the distracted mind because it's not much grounding in that, in the present moment. And so they want, the distracting mind can wander off very easily. But when there's a distinct and clear act, mental act of really recognizing this is what's happening now, that's a moment of being grounded. And it might just be a moment or two, but then if you do it repeatedly, it becomes more and more of a grounding here, and there's less room, less energy for distractions. The same thing with sensing. If you do a discrete, clear moment of sensing, oh, this is what it feels like. This also is a grounding that is maybe more useful for to prevent you getting distracted than just general attention. And if distraction happens anyway, then what you described is very good. But what we do with mindfulness practice, the way we teach it here at IMC, is with enough distraction, then you make the distraction the focus of your attention. You clearly recognize you're distracting. You clearly feel what it's like to be distracted. And only after doing that do you relax something. Is that enough?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And Lydia.
Hi, Gil. You mentioned that there's three factors. The first one, knowing, is that the Buddha taught in the Satipatthana discourse. The third one, the Buddha taught in the Anapanasati discourse. What is the second one for the sensing?
So the first tetrad, the first four exercises in Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing, are also the first four exercises in the foundation of mindfulness discourse. So they both share these what we're teaching here. So there's four exercises, but the first two have to do with knowing. The third one is sensing, feeling, having the physical experience of it. And then the fourth is calming.
I see. Okay, so there's three factors are coming from the first tetra.
Right.
Of the Anapanasati.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we have Margaret.
Hi, Gil. Thank you for this course. It's been wonderful. I guess I'm also confused, as Lydia was, about sensing, because you said feeling. And so I was thinking of Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. But it's not that. It's a mental faculty.
Is it a mental faculty? I realize that's confusing to use the word feeling. What I meant by feel in Vedana, a feeling is the object of attention. And so we can say that I'm having a feeling versus the verb to be feeling. I'm feeling the wind against my cheek. I'm feeling the cold. So and so then we're not referring to the feeling tone. We're just feeling to the sensations that we're aware of.
Okay.
And so this the word that the Pali word for this is not Vedana. It's a Patisamvedati, which means to experience, to sense, and so it's a sensing. In that sense, it's feeling.
So it's a somatic experience.
Yeah, the somatic experience. Well, you know, it, Somatic might be too limited because it's also, it's the hearing, which is also done, the somatic side of hearing, the somatic smelling, tasting.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Jerry.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Unless I'm totally lost, I'm wondering, where does intuition fit in between knowing and sensing?
I put intuition in the same category as wisdom. It's a higher order understanding of something that is not one of the faculties of attention. It's a faculty of understanding. Great.
Okay, thank you. Something to think about. Thank you.
Anne.
I guess I'm asking the question because I'm not an English native speaker, but there are always those three words, attention, awareness, and mindfulness. And I'm always a little bit confused about them. Like, it's kind of like, in the end, the same thing, or what is like the distinction between the three words?
Even English speakers are confused.
Okay, that makes me feel better.
how I'm using the words today. So it's a nice question you ask. I used words attention, awareness, and mindfulness as synonyms of each other. And that's different than how mindfulness is used in some circles in Theravadan Buddhism and how mindfulness is used in secular mindfulness that's so popular here in the West now. And so, if you're taking the Majjhima course, right? So you're going to get my essay about the sati. Maybe you already received it, where I argue for translating sati as awareness rather than mindfulness. So I use the word attention, awareness kind of synonymously, and mindfulness kind of that way as well. I tend to use the word mindfulness to refer to mindfulness practice as opposed to a particular faculty of attention. So it involves more than just a particular faculty. It's a combination of these component parts that come into play. And so I know that's confusing to these linguistic, using these words differently than how other people use them, but hopefully you'll get a hang of it or at least forgive me. So then Kelly.
Thank you, Gary. Well, seems like attention and awareness is the same thing to me. And what's the difference?
Yeah, I treat them the same. I think of them the same. The only difference might be that attention I use sometimes as an umbrella term that includes more than just awareness. It includes knowing, sensing, observing. So any capacity we have for perceiving anything belongs in this umbrella term for attention. So in that sense, it's a little bit more than just awareness, because awareness is also, in my vocabulary, is something somewhat specific. It's not general. It's its own thing, whereas attention is not its own thing. It'd be like using the word color. Color doesn't, it's not its own thing. It's an umbrella term for all colors.
Oh, okay.
And so something like that.
Seems to me it's the other way around. Like awareness is umbrella term for, attention and mindfulness and everything.
It could be.
I don't know.
I mean, and this is where I was saying earlier that how we personally, how our minds work around this and how we experience it and how we understand it is very, very personal. And so I think it's important not to take anybody as an expert or any book as being clearly saying this is how it works, but rather you're getting you have to hear like you're getting suggestions and ideas with which to look at how your mind works, and then decide for yourself what actually helps you to understand, what is fits you. Or say, well, that was interesting what he said or she said or they said. But you know, my mind works differently. Thank you. I understand it differently. I practice with it in a different way. And so I'm more interested in helping you see the tools and landmarks in your own mind than you have to fit what I'm saying.
Yeah, thank you, Gira.
Great, thank you. So then, is it Ming?
Yes. Talking about the difference between sensing and knowing, for a long while, I noticed that there's sequencing in my mind. I always noticing the sensing part. And then later on, I know the second, I noticed that the knowing. But then this morning, after this two breathing meditation exercise, I realized that my mind could be sensing and knowing at one single second. That means that I think if the analogy is if the mind is strong and calm enough, these two things could be in one moment happening. I don't know whether this observation is correct. So I'm just curious about your suggestions.
Yeah, before we go on, we don't have enough time for everyone who raised their hand now. So Abraham, you'll have to wait, or you can stay on after we finish and I'll talk to you. So the tradition of Vipassana does have a place for exactly what you're talking about, that it's possible to see, and this is why seeing is an important term, idea at some point, it's possible to see how sensing and knowing can occur more or less at the same time, but they're distinct. They're two different things. Mm-hmm. And this is actually a very helpful insight to have, because when knowing and sensing are combined too closely together, glued together, that's when we tend to see things as being more permanent. But when we see they're two separate things and not glued together, then there's more room to see the change that's always there. Does that make sense? An answer to
that? Yeah, very good. Permanent versus impermanent. Yes, great. I understand the difference. Thank you.
Great. Mary.
I guess I'm wondering, is concentration a component of attention, or where does concentration fit into all of this, or am I really off base?
No, it's a good question. And maybe different people would have different answers to your question. But my answer is that concentration is a different tool that supports attention, supports mindfulness and all that. And so it would be kind of like you have a telescope that you're going to look at the moon with. And so that's the main tool for looking at the moon, but you're not going to see the moon very well if you're holding a telescope in your hand. You put it on a tripod, and then it's stable. So concentration is the tripod for awareness.
Yeah, thank you. And just one more thing: how important is it for concentration to be like kind of sequential rather than dipping into it? Do you know what I mean?
It's a great question. What would happen if I let you discover that answer for yourself?
Well, I'll try, but it just produces more questions. Yes. You know what? The thing is, I guess for me, concentration has always been a formidable word. And so I was always, I still feel that kind of fear in myself of thinking I have to concentrate. So attention seems to have a softer landing when I hear it.
Fantastic. Yeah, so stay with that. And if you want a word that's a synonym for concentration that might work a little bit better, with your attention, be steady.
Ah, thank you. Thank you.
So Leslie, if you could be short, because I'd like to stop at 12:15 now. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's short. It's I recognized during the exercise that knowing is the one that I don't emphasize. And I wonder if I suffer more during my meditation practice because I'm so sensing and observing. If you have any experience with other meditators who are very much in their body, is then knowing kind of a pulling back and maybe releases the struggles more?
Yes. I think that I've seen people who are more sensors, sensing things a lot, and they do struggle much more than they need to because there's not enough recognition and intelligence engaged. And knowing brings much more intelligence into the picture and much more seeing the bigger picture of what's going on. So it's really helpful. So for people who sense more than know, emphasizing knowing can bring it into balance. But the opposite is true too. The people who are real knowers sometimes need to have the sensing to bring themselves into balance.
Thank you.
Great. That was great. So let's stop. And we'll start again here in an hour and 13 minutes. So in California at 1:30. Thank you for this morning. And I hope that this is the right balance of teachings and discussion and meditation. We'll come back. We'll do two more meditations in the afternoon and one more small group, a triad group to have a discussion in the afternoon as well. And then at the end of the afternoon, I'll kind of go over some of the logistics for this program that would be useful for you to know. So thank you, and I'll see you again in a little over an hour.